Okay, I think that's most people in. Welcome. Good morning, everybody. For those of you that don't know me, my name is Peter. I'm a partner with Specialist Employment and Business Immigration Practice, MPM Legal. We're based in the south of England and we help employers all over the world that have one thing in common, which is employing people here in the UK. I am delighted to be joined by my colleague, Adrienne. Good morning, Adrienne.
Morning, morning.
It feels like it's been a while since we've done one of these together, but it's probably only a few weeks, isn't it?
I know. Yeah, sorry. I just thought I'd let you do it on your own while I
Yeah,
was
well,
sunning myself.
I know. Well, almost. well, it's great to have you back.
Thanks.
Just a couple of housekeeping points. Those of you that are regulars will know we'll take questions as we go. We'll try and handle them as we go along. Please just use the Q&A function down at the bottom because it helps us just manage them. Please also use the chat function if you've got any comments on what we're talking about. It's always good to see the comments in the chat, so please use that. This session is being recorded. You can find all of our recordings on the MPM Legal website. Those of you who are listening to this on Spotify will of course know you can get our back issues on Spotify, Amazon Music, and Apple, and wherever else you listen to your podcast. So look out for some of our 70 plus back episodes on there. Okay, let's get into today's session. What are we talking about today? Well, we wanted to have a look at constructive dismissal. And really, there's been a recent case. So we wanted to see what the recent case is saying about how employment tribunals actually apply the principles of constructive dismissal in real life.
I mean, it's one of those things, and for me, it comes up on the occasions where sometimes I'm advising employees who feel like they've been poorly treated or they've not been paid a bonus or something like that, and they go, "I think I've got a constructive dismissal case," and it is one of those areas that people think they understand until they're suddenly caught in the middle of a dispute like that, and then it becomes surprisingly technical. So what we thought we'd do today is just to unpack it a little bit, using the recent case to guide us through it.
Yep, absolutely. That case is an Employment Appeal Tribunal case, and it's the case of Barry and Upper Thames Medical Group. I'll share a link afterwards to it, or I'll stick one in a chat shortly. But Barry and Upper Thames Medical Group, and this case, it's a good illustration of what not to assume if you're an employer, and it also clarifies something that we see, which causes quite a bit of misunderstanding. And that question is, when does an employee's delay in resigning actually amount to an affirmation of the contract? So an acceptance of something that may have changed in the contract. Here's the spoiler. The Employment Appeal Tribunal says not nearly as quickly as some employers might think. So just bear that in mind. So let's have a look at the background to this case. Well, the facts are Dr. Barry was a GP who'd suffered from laryngitis and then an autoimmune illness, and she'd had long periods of sickness absence. And in the summer of 2020, she attended a capability meeting, and afterwards she had a relapse and went into another extended period of absence. So quite a bit of absence going on here, right?
Absolutely. Things really kicked off is in the September of 2020, her employer, the GP practice, told her that no further sick pay would be paid, presumably in line with their policy. Now, but she believed that she was entitled to more sick pay and that the refusal to pay her was the fundamental breach of contract that she was complaining about. Now, that's quite a serious allegation because it goes straight to the implied term of mutual trust and confidence. Now, for those of you that know that, that's fine. Those of you that don't, implied into every contract of employment is this mutual trust and confidence term, i.e., both parties behave in that way towards each other. And if any behaviours undermine that, then that's also a breach of that implied duty. So I just thought I'd add that in there.
No, absolutely. I mean, lots of implied terms, and we come across this idea of written contracts of employment, but even in the best drafted employment contracts, there'll always be terms that are implied into everybody's contract without a requirement to have them expressly written down.
That's a whole nother webinar,
It's a
that
whole
one, though,
nother
isn't
webinar. Let's do that another time.
it?
So back to this case and Dr. Barry. Instead of resigning straight away, she did what most people would do, which is to try and sort things out. So she was negotiating with her employer, and in this particular case, a lot of her negotiations were handled by her trade union rep. Some of those negotiations were also done on a without prejudice basis. Now, at one point, she was told by the GP or the doctor's practice manager manager that she might actually be owed sick pay to the tune of over £9,000. So not an insignificant sum. And that's key because it means that the employee's thinking, all right, there's an opportunity here that this situation might still be fixed. And maybe this whole thing is a misunderstanding and I'm going to get paid what I think I should be paid. So I think in her mind, she's holding off on resigning. She's hoping that this breach will still be remedied by her employer. Now, what did the tribunal do when they looked at it?
Well, so the tribunal took a much more black and white approach, which is probably the approach that most employers would take. And you know, to be fair, sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And that's kind of what we'll wrap up in this session. But they basically said she learned in September that she wouldn't be paid the sick pay. She didn't resign until April 2021. So that's what, well, my maths is a bit rubbish, 7 or 8 months after learning of the thing that she was arguing was the breach. And the tribunal said, that's just simply too long. You delayed too long before you resigned. And she had also said in December 2020 that she wanted to return to work. Now, that statement, they said, was reaffirming the contract. And what I mean by that is she accepted the breach. She kind of agreed that the contract was going to continue and reaffirmed it by continuing to be employed by them. So the problem with this, well, essentially what the EAT was saying is that this is a really simplistic reading of the timeline, and the tribunal didn't properly analyse why she had delayed. So they treated delay plus the positive noises as automatically meaning that she was reaffirming the contract. So what did the EAT say then, Peter?
Well, they came along and they said, hang on a minute, this is not actually how affirmation works.
Yeah, exactly. So what they looked at was the things, the negotiations. So they said the tribunal almost completely ignored the fact that the parties were actually in the process of trying to resolve the issue. And further, that key point that Peter talked about earlier, the practice manager saying that she might be due £9,000 worth of sick pay, that gave her real hope of getting the money she believed she was owed. So the negotiations mattered. That was important as part of this factual matrix. The tribunal also had treated the fact that she was represented by her union as evidence of acceptance. And the EAT said the complete opposite. I mean, and I don't really understand why the tribunal made that statement. And I agree with the EAT, who said, well, the union involvement showed that she was challenging the breach and she was using her union to support that challenge. So then the third point for the EAT was that her December statement wasn't inconsistent. So the statement that she wanted to return to work in December, because it wasn't just, I will return to work in December. She said she would return if the sick pay dispute was sorted. And that's totally compatible with her position that not paying sick pay was the breach and remained the breach. And, you know, there were negotiations to try and resolve it. So what the EAT says is the law is clear. Delay may be evidence of affirmation, but it is not determinative on its own, especially where the employee is taking steps to try and resolve the breach.
Yeah. I mean, that's the key finding in this case is that ultimately she hadn't affirmed the contract, meaning she hadn't kind of accepted any breach and just then carried on working in that situation. The EAT were clear her resignation was still in response to the breach, and that led crucially to the finding that she was constructively dismissed.
Yeah.
So the employment tribunal got it wrong, unfortunately.
Yeah.
I mean, you and I, we see constructive dismissal situations all the time, and we're litigating several at the moment. I thought it'd be worthwhile just having a look at the kind of mechanics, the ingredients, if you like, of a constructive dismissal claim and what it actually looks like. So should we talk about that for a little bit? What are those elements in terms of
what's the fundamentals
what
needed?
Are the fundamentals?
Yeah. First and foremost, you need the employee needs to be saying there's a repudiatory breach of my contract. What does repudiatory mean? It's a fancy name for something that is a really serious breach that essentially means that it rips up the contract of employment between the parties. So very often in constructive dismissal cases, when we're talking to employers, or even when we are at preliminary hearings in a tribunal case, we will be be asking the employee to identify what is that repudiatory breach. And there is a massive amount of case law on whether it needs to be one thing or whether it can be a drip, drip, drip over time with the last straw, which makes the employee go, right, that's it, I've had enough. But a repudiatory breach is the first fundamental needed for a claim. Then the employee has got to resign in response to that breach, right? So I don't like the way that's happened. That's a breach. I'm off. Okay. Sometimes what we see is an employee who secures a new job and then resigns. So, of course, then from our perspective, we're looking at saying, well, actually, you may not have resigned in response to the breach. You may have resigned because you've got a new job. That's not necessarily a hands down winning argument because there's a load of stuff around that. I'm not going to cover it because we haven't got time. And the third point is this point that we've already kind of covered about whether or not the employee has affirmed the contract first. So what conduct, what behaviour, what have they done which might lead a tribunal to believe that the employee has accepted that the contract is continuing?
And I think a lot of the cases that we see or situations before they actually make it to an employment tribunal really hinge on this third aspect and around affirmation. And the reason for that is what we see is employees often not resigning straight away. And it's understandable because life's complicated, right? People need a job, they need income, they don't want to surrender notice pay. You know, it's quite a brave step to walk away from paid employment. They may want to go and get legal advice, or they may be taking steps, like we saw in this EAT case, to actually try and salvage the employment relationship. So, you know, it's not always the case that employees are going to jump absolutely straight away. And that's why this issue of reaffirmation becomes really, really critical. But before you get to that, the other sort of cloudy area we see as well is around what is the actual repudiatory breach, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So obviously, in this case that we were talking about, stopping contractual sick pay can absolutely be a repudiatory breach. That's like stopping paying somebody. But it doesn't have to be as obvious as that. It can be a botched disciplinary process. It can be an unfair suspension. It can be a unilateral change to hours or pay, or, you know, some tasks in a job description, removal of direct reports, you know, a breakdown in trust and confidence. We talked about that mutual trust and confidence. So if there's poor communication going on, that can amount to a repudiatory breach. And then, of course, we've got things like the bullying or toxic management allegations that we see quite a lot through grievance processes. So there's a whole raft of things really that can come within that definition.
Yeah, the other thing that we spot as well is often it's not the action or the underlying thing, but the way that it's done that can tip something into breach territory. So for example, I've certainly seen situations where somebody's raised a complaint about something, and the thing they're complaining about, there isn't much merit or any merit in the complaint. Okay. And so the individual's brought a complaint because they're unhappy about something, but the underlying complaint, there's no real issue when looked at objectively. Okay. So there's no particular employment law liability. But the employer just makes a complete hash in terms of dealing with the complaint. So particularly around grievances. So to give an easy example, an employer just completely disregards its grievance policy. It doesn't hold meetings in the time frame, but crucially, it doesn't explain that to the individual who's raised the complaint. So it doesn't keep them informed of timescales. The individual might be off sick. You know, there might be something wider going on. And instead of being communicative and kind of managing that whole process, they just completely botch handling the complaint. Remember, in my scenario, the underlying complaint doesn't have any merit. Actually, the manner in which you deal with that stuff can of itself create a breach of the implied term. And the employee can seize on that point and say, OK, it's the manner in which I've been treated since I've raised this issue that has now led me to question trust and confidence in the employment relationship to the extent that actually I'm going to go and I'm going to bring a constructive dismissal claim.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Second point then, resignation must be linked to the breach. So this case reinforces the useful point. The employee doesn't need to resign immediately. They need to resign because of the breach. I will caveat that, though, but in that they can't obviously delay it too long. But the tribunals will have to look at the employee's intention. Were they trying to fix things? Were they raising the grievances, and all of that helps lay and put the factual matrix around that decision. Then it's onto the affirmation bit, isn't it? This is the tricky bit. really,
Which
because
is really tricky. And employers sometimes think, actually, this relates to a question someone's put in the chat, which I'll come to in a second. Thanks, Chris. But employers sometimes think, well, if the employee doesn't resign by Friday, then we're fine. We're in the clear. It's all right. But the law actually says something that's a lot more nuanced than that. And the legal position is actually delay in resigning may suggest affirmation, but it's not enough on its own. So it's not simply sufficient to say the employee's delayed resigning, therefore we're completely in the clear. Attempts to resolve the situation can count against affirmation, and mixed messages from the employer can also reset the clock as well. So a good way to think about it is, has the employee acted in a way that's really inconsistent with treating the breach as being serious? And if not, then the contract probably isn't affirmed. And I know that this is a minefield of an area, Adrian, but it sort of neatly, I mean, maybe you can speak to Chris's question actually about this kind of protest point.
I mean, there's a number of things here. So, for example, what happens if an employee takes advantage of certain benefits, like a bonus, or perhaps enhanced family leave and pay? You know, that type of behavior can very much be supportive of an employee affirming the contract. Chris's question about, employees working under protest, very often they'll make their complaint and they'll say, "I'm working under protest. I'm really unhappy about this situation." And that may be fine to explain the delay, if they are, if the facts around that also support it. So, if, for example, the employee says, "I want to make it clear that I'm working under protest. I'm bringing a grievance," and they are in the thick of a grievance process, or they're, or they're in the thick of discussions with their manager. It doesn't have to be a formal grievance process, but the point is there needs to be some kind of active and live complaint that is being processed and being driven by the employee. Then that's likely to be okay in terms of explaining the delay. If, however, they've exhausted the grievance process and they still say, "Oh, I'm still really unhappy and I'm working under protest," but they continue to work, then at least there is a big risk for them that what they're doing is going to delay and therefore defeat their claim for constructive dismissal. So it's not just about the working under protest, it's looking about the context around which they're making that message. And there's quite a few cases on this which talk to this factual matrix. For example, there was one that I looked at, which said that, grievance had been decided and the employee waited 6 weeks before resigning, and that was enough to defeat her claim for constructive dismissal because there was no active reason why there was that delay of the 6 week period. The grievance had been done, it was all over, and it's at that point that the employee has to make the decision: do I jump or do I stay? And that's where the delay is potentially problematic for them. I also just wanted to quickly just cover, we get qu asked questions, does an employee, might get an employee coming to me and saying, "I think it's constructive dismissal, but, I want to give notice. I've got bills to pay, mortgage to pay, et cetera," all the rest of it. And, there's queries around if they give notice, particularly if they've got like a 3 month notice period. Again, is that enough to delay it? And it's not clear. I mean, my advice is always, well, there's a risk unless you've got anything live going on, any complaints, et cetera. It's all about your behaviors, your conducts, your messaging to the employer. Giving notice and working it, where you're continuing to receive pay and benefits, or you're taking sick pay if you're off sick during notice, all of that can very much be evidence of affirmation of the contract.
Yeah, I think it's so context specific, isn't it? And we've certainly seen cases where employees have been able to successfully argue that them giving notice has not amounted to affirmation of contract, although the employers understandably run that argument. But it depends probably on the type of breach that you're alleging in terms of the underlying reasons for it, and the sort of context in which that individual is working. So, I mean, of course, we're going to say this, but always take advice if, you're in a situation where you're dealing with an employee who's threatening constructive dismissal or making noises about fundamental breach of contract or purportedly trying to give notice. And, we can navigate you through that. Okay, let's just have a look now at some of the sort of more practical tips in terms of decision making and not ending up too easily in a situation where you might be creating an environment that gives rise to a constructive dismissal claim. And before we get into that, can I just remind you that you can get all of our back recordings on Spotify and also on our website, NPM Legal, as well. If you are listening to this on Spotify, it helps us massively if you can rate the podcast on the app. Which I believe you can rate it from the mobile version of Spotify. For those of you that are joining live, and I know that you'd like to join to be able to ask questions and enter into discussion with other participants as well. If you know anybody else that you think would be interested in joining us, please do spread the word. The more the merrier. We're always happy to welcome new participants to these sessions. So, in terms of decision-making process, I think my first tip is just being careful with decisions that might give rise to fundamental breaches. Now, I know saying that out loud, it seems super, super obvious, but you would be surprised at some of the discussions we have where changes are contemplated and the manner in which those changes are actually positioned. So, certainly making unilateral significant changes like stopping sick pay, removing benefits, changing somebody's role, these are all quite impactful changes for individuals and they do need careful handling. So, you've got to have confidence in terms of what your contractual position is. It's always worth sense checking what are our options here in terms of ability to make the change that we're looking at. That's one part of it. The other part of it, and this is, part of my mantra, I think, in employment issues and employee relations stuff generally, key communication. Key, clear, transparent communication goes a massively long way to reducing the scope for employee conflict. So communicating your plans clearly, having that plan in advance. So that's around change processes. What about consistent communications, Adrienne?
Well, it's quite funny, wasn't it? Because in this case, the throwaway point by the practice manager saying, "Oh, it's likely that, there's every chance you could be owed sick pay." That was probably the practice manager maybe trying to be kind. We don't know the context, but that sentence turned out to be pretty critical in the EAT's thinking. And the practice manager probably didn't have any idea that might be the case when the words came out of her mouth. So be really careful on unintentionally creating false hope. There are occasions where you think you might want to be kind and you might want to be encouraging. Just be really, really careful in terms of what you say, because that certainly muddied the waters in this case. So yeah, I think in that sense, it's like what you were saying before about a grievance process. If something's raised that looks to be just ridiculous, don't automatically think it's the case and brush it off. And that's the sort of like the communication piece. It's like, well, if you follow your process, if you take it seriously, even if you have a decent conversation with the employee and you make them feel that they're heard, you're behaving in a way that preserves the trust and confidence, which is that implied term we talked about. So it is critical. I mean, it's critical in everything employment. I think it's the root of all evils is poor communication, but there we are.
But I think there's an opportunity as well. Like if you're working on the HR side of things, to be really clear with your managers who might be doing the day-to-day meetings with an individual. So there's consistency between what you would expect to have happen and the risks that you know about, and that the manager or the individual handling a particular situation is on the same page as you, and you're not diverging from those from that particular approach. So that's where it's really gonna help you. Third tip, don't assume that delay is your friend, as we now know from this case. So if an employee sticks around for 6 months trying to resolve a dispute, that's probably not going to count as affirmation of a breach. So, tribunals will expect employees to explore options before resigning, certainly if individuals are not raising grievances concerning potential breaches. It can impact on the value of their claim, because we would say non-compliance with the ACAS code of practice, reduction in the compensatory award. Those of you that are familiar with that will know what I'm talking about. So don't just assume we're going to be out of the woods because somebody has not acted quickly enough. Yes, it's going to give you an argument. Yes, in certain cases, it is going to be a slam dunk argument, but not in every single case, as we've seen. So don't assume delay is your friend.
I mean, if you're going through a grievance process and an employee says, use the example, an employee takes 6 months to try and resolve a dispute. Now, we know in the commercial world that grievances do take quite a long time, probably far longer than they used to. But if you think about actually dealing with them promptly, really getting on with it, then frankly, from a commercial and financial point of view, you are paying the employee for a much shorter period of time while you're going through looking into their dispute, meaning that the decision that they have to then make once the process is followed comes a lot sooner, and it's just in bog terms of finances, it is easy. You've got to think about saving the money that way, but also that's obviously going to be in line with the fairness, the ACAS code, your grievance policy, which probably says something like we'll invite you to a meeting within 5 days, which it's really difficult to actually stick to that for a lot of the time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the other things to think about then is encouraging early open dialogue. We've talked a lot about whether somebody would have a constructive dismissal claim. Well, what about trying to prevent it from happening in the first place? Because obviously that's better. So, think about things like mediation that might actually prevent a claim in the first place. Think about the processes or the meetings that you can have where the employee feels listened to, that they've been heard. Even if the outcome isn't what they want, it can sometimes de-escalate the situation if the time is taken to take the employee on the journey so that they can understand the decision making. It's not going to prevent it all of the time, but it's always steps which are useful to try and de-escalate, as we say.
Yeah, absolutely. So my next tip, when negotiations are happening, expect the affirmation issued to stay open, so to still be there. So once you're in a dispute with an employee, it's safe to assume the employee is reserving their position unless they say otherwise. Now, at a later date, we may get into the technicalities around whether an employee has actually said my rights are reserved or I'm reserving my position here, pending resolution of this. That's something that we would be investigating as part of any potential defence to a claim. But in the meantime, working on the assumption that the employee is reserving their position is helpful because it gives you the mindset that, okay, we may still have an issue here that we need resolving. So just expect that that affirmation issue is still a live one rather than making an assumption that it's all closed off because negotiations are going on. That's a dangerous kind of trap to fall into.
Yeah.
Someone else has raised a question. Thanks, Helen. Would raising a grievance be considered a dispute in relation to a without prejudice discussion? I think that is WP discussion. Mm. Yeah, probably. I mean, if someone's raising a grievance about, obviously it's context specific. It depends what the grievance actually says. But someone may, for example, be alleging that the conduct of a without prejudice discussion was discriminatory because of what was said. And seek to raise a complaint in respect of that. But I think the short answer to your question is yes. And what do you think, Adrian?
Yeah, I agree. Absolutely, yeah. I agree. Because, if it's there is a dispute and that's why they've raised a grievance, and I think there's definitely scope to argue it under the case law.
Yeah.
I've got one commercial point that I just wanted to add to the end of it. I expect most of you know, but if an employee resigns and goes for constructive dismissal, one of the arguments they can run is that any post-termination restrictions will fall away. So it may be that you're in a situation where an employee wants to engineer a constructive dismissal claim so they can get out of their restrictions. And yeah. I'm not saying that's always the case, but that's kind of a side impact potentially of that action. So be alive to that in your business. And that should form part and parcel of, seeking advice, trying to map your way through it to not forget that as a consideration, because I think it's a really important one for the business, particularly if you're looking for salespeople, perhaps, who've fallen out over commission payments and can say, we haven't paid me properly, therefore I'm off to your biggest competitor, free of restrictions. Oh, and by the way, I can start on Monday. And I'm still going to bring a constructive dismissal case because I've still suffered some losses. So those should all form part and parcel of your thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And also help to drive any kind of resolution process as well. So, probably the takeaway is if you're sensing that the trust and confidence is eroding, don't wait for a resignation letter. Pick up the phone to HR, legal, and let's map out a strategy plan.
Yeah. And your reference to post-termination restrictions, it's a really, really good point. And actually, amongst all the noise of the budget yesterday, you might have escaped the announcement the government made, which is they're opening a review into post-termination restrictions. So non-compete clauses, non-dealing, non-solicitation clauses. So there's a consultation because they're going to be looking at whether to cap the enforceability of those, whether to take them away for people who earn a certain salary. So have a look for that consultation because that would be quite interesting to see what the government is going to do there. Okay, conscious of time, thanks for bearing with us. Just to sum up, this EAT case we've talked about, it's a really useful reminder that affirmation is very fact sensitive and tribunals want to see the whole picture and not just look at a specific timeline. So context is key. Hopefully, you know, you get the sense of that from what we've been talking about in the past half an hour about the context and the fact sensitivity of constructive dismissal cases.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, it just underlines just because an employee hasn't resigned quickly, don't rest on your laurels and think that it's okay.
No, absolutely not. Hope you enjoyed that session. Just a snapshot of constructive dismissal in practice. I think always worth revisiting because, you know, at some point or another, it will unfortunately come across your desk as an issue. Hopefully it gives you a bit of confidence in terms of how to handle a tricky situation without actually creating a bigger problem for yourself, though. Donna's asked, when's the recorded version of this session going to be available? Probably during the course of next week. We'll have two to put up because the session that we did last week on, or 2 weeks ago, on Employment Rights Bill and trade union reforms. So if you're in a unionised workplace or you think you might be in the future because of these changes, that's well worth a listen to. So this session and that session will be going live next week. We're back in 2 weeks' time. It will be our last session, incredibly, of 2025. So that's going to be on the 11th of December. Not sure on the topic yet. We may do a wrap-up of the year. What we will do in January is kick off with a What's on the Horizon session as well. So look out for our session in 2 weeks' time. Look out for our session in early January. If we don't see you next week, have a wonderful Christmas as well. But for now, enjoy the rest of your week and thanks for joining today. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you. Bye.